Wir sind Theresa und
Nemo.
Und deshalb sind wir zu Shopify gewechselt.
Die Plattform, die wir vor Shopify verwendet haben, hat regelmäßig Updates gebraucht, die teilweise dazu geführt haben, dass der Shop nicht funktioniert hat.
Endlich macht unser Nemo-Boards-Shop dadurch auch auf den Mobilgeräten eine gute Figur. Und die Illustrationen auf den Boards kommen jetzt viel, viel klarer rüber, was uns ja auch wichtig ist und was unsere Marke auch ausmacht.
Starte deinen Test noch heute für 1 Euro pro Monat auf shopify.de/radio.
My wife and I met when I was 17, and we were together until she passed at 29. All that momentum, marriage, children, moving in together, growing together, it just stopped before most of it could even happen. We built a life together, carved one out of our shared space. It's hard to describe what it's like growing up with someone like that, just how important she was to me. I find it weird that sometimes people talk about healing, but I feel more like a guy who's lost a limb. Something's been taken from me, and I'm okay with it now. I'm still me, but I'm not, quote, getting better. I lost half of myself, and she's not growing back. I spent a long time in a kind of limbo, only breaking free of it recently when I found some troll was using her photo on Facebook. At first, seeing a face on an active profile made me feel numb. Soon after, I was sick, and then, well, I started clicking around trying to find out more. My wife never had Facebook, so it didn't make much sense why she'd be on there, posthumously or otherwise. But then again, it wasn't her name or her life on show. The whole account was public, and I could see clearly how this person had spent the last 2 years harassing and bullying a whole town over Facebook. Unlike a lot of groups, all the pages for this town, Patterside, West Virginia, were public, and I could see everything the fake account had posted, along with all the replies from everyone else. This troll account would do things like post lewd links to church pages, make gross remarks to underage girls on school graduation photos, and even threaten bake sales with poisoning. Every post got hundreds, sometimes thousands of negative responses from people living in the town. They'd beg to be left alone, call them disgusting perverts, tell each other to ignore the troll, insult them. I decided to reach out to someone on the page. I explained who the image had come from and that it wasn't very nice seeing her picture used in that way, and if they knew who it was, could they pass their details on to me? An hour or two later, I got a message of one Arlene Dollas. "Hi," she wrote. "So sorry to hear about this. I lost my brother when I was younger, and if something like this happened to his image, I'd be devastated. Unfortunately, we don't know who this person is. I'll try and ask some of the people around here to maybe avoid making physical comments about the image, if you think that would help. I'm not sure they'd actually listen, but I'd still be happy to try. By the way, just wanted to say, I love your work." For a moment, I was a little confused. None of my paintings were posted to my Facebook page, but after some searching, I found a link in my bio that led to my Twitter and my website. I thought it was oddly flattering that someone would even bother digging it out, and that little bit of snooping felt like an open invitation. So, I started looking through Arlene's account in return. She was a sculptor, talented and skillful, but not a genius. A bit like me, good but not great. Still, I found her work fascinating. Most were a kind of pseudo-primitive approach to the human shape. Most of them were abstract, some painted, but throughout them all, I felt a thematic connection between our work. "Hi," I wrote back. "I really appreciate if you could ask them that. And I just want to say, I love your work too. The lady with the violin is absolutely beautiful. Do you make a lot of sales?" "Thank you," she replied. "But no, people around here aren't really art lovers." I decided that I liked Arlene. Her cover photo was a little blurry, possibly cropped, but it showed a sweet-looking woman about my age with a big grin and brown eyes, and I thought she looked pretty. Over the next few days, we kept messaging each other. I even bought one of her sculptures for $10, and she shipped it to my address. Weirdly, I found myself browsing the Patterside community page more and more, keeping mental track of the various relationships, gossip, feuds, and upcoming social events that dominated their lives. And there was more than just one group. There was a local school, and each graduation year had its own page, going right the way back to 1982. There were local groups for knitting clubs, single mothers, book clubs, farmers, model airplane enthusiasts, cheerleaders, chess clubs, the high school football team. All of them public. And I gotta admit, it was kind of fascinating to go through the whole town like it was an open book. Over the next few weeks, I found myself daydreaming about Patterside. Sometimes I even dreamed about living a life there. One where I was friends with my neighbour, and I attended church, and I had crushes who would sometimes break my heart and sometimes like me back. A life where people gossiped about me the way I gossiped about them. Where I had a job where most of my time was spent checking boxes. A place where I returned to a home I was proud of, and where I had friends who cared about me. But the next thing on the horizon was a church jumble, or a harvest festival, or a school prom that needed supervision. Meanwhile, Arlene and I kept up our back and forth. I started showing her my half-finished work to get her feedback, something I hadn't even done with my wife, and she did the same for me. After some time, we exchanged numbers and started texting, talking to each other about our shared problems. Arlene had suffered a lot at the hands of an abusive ex, and I thought she latched onto a long-distance relationship because it gave her so much more control over the boundaries. Even when she told me she'd need more time before speaking to me via video or voice chat, I understood why, and I appreciated her honesty. Over the next few months, we grew close. At the time, I couldn't say if it was a real romantic relationship, whatever that means, but it was very intense. And, given where I was in my life, I let myself be drawn into Arlene's orbit until I was texting her 3 or 4 times an hour for nearly a whole year. We talked about everything, laying all of our pain out in the open for the other to see. And while her trauma and mine were quite different, I found that she still understood my grief in a way no one else ever had, not even other widowers. It was hard to follow her rules. I spoke to her about this, not to challenge her about them, but simply because it upset me, and I shared everything with her. She was sympathetic, but still quite firm in stating her need for space. But something that made it much harder was when she revealed her suspicions that Patterside's troll was her abusive ex. She told me over and over how upset she would be if I ever tried contacting them. If it was her ex, she said, then revealing our relationship would make them 1,000 times more aggressive. And yet, even while I was aware of the stakes, I still struggled to keep my jealousy and anger at arm's length. Until, inevitably, I messaged them. I was drunk at the time, barely able to even stand. But I guess that's irrelevant, since I still broke a promise to a very good friend. The troll's response, however, was different to what I expected. They didn't laugh at me, or goad me, or even threaten me. Instead, they sent a video, and it was just about the oddest thing I'd ever seen. It was shot on a phone and showed someone maneuvering their way through a burned-down house. You could hear rain and see glimpses of other houses through the gaps in the crumbling wall. Charcoal beams and cinders lay across the floor in jumbled heaps, and when the camera moved, I saw that the roof above was sagging and close to collapse. No one spoke, but I could make out the strained breathing of the cameraman as they picked their way through the rubble until they reached a small corner of the house. There, they leaned down and, with gloved hands, began to pull aside bricks and fallen plasterboard until the bare floor was revealed. Carefully, they wiped away the remaining debris and dust until a barely visible trapdoor was just about visible in the floor. Reaching down and pulling it aside, they revealed a single ladder descending into empty darkness. Quietly, they stood over it, their strained breathing heavier than before. And then click. The video ended. I didn't quite know what to make of it, so I dismissed it. Instead, I spent my time worrying about what Arlene would do if she found out I'd broken my promise. And yet, despite that broken promise, nothing else happened over the next few days. The troll carried on as normal, as did Arlene, and for a while, I thought that maybe, that might just be the end of it. That somehow, I'd gotten away with baiting the troll and that it wouldn't come back to haunt me. That was until, towards the end of the week, I received a package. Straight away, I recognized it as a canvas, and a large one at that. The return address was a familiar one, since it was the one Arlene used when she'd sent me gifts. But this was clearly no gift from her. For one thing, she couldn't paint. And as I tore away the brown wrapping paper, I saw a remarkable painting made by someone of incredible skill. It showed an eye staring at me out of total darkness. Something about his effect was quite uncanny. Up close, the darkness that took up almost all of the canvas was painted a uniform black. But when I stood back, there was the sense of looking at something hidden, as though I could just about glimpse the murky outline of whoever the eye belonged to. The owner's eye, I guessed, was not meant to be human, for the deep oily greens and blacks and conflicting yellows that made up the iris and sclera left me feeling as though the watcher was hideous and lecherous, leering at me out of the darkness with fear and anger. Bluish veins with unhealthy metallic sheens threaded the vitreous jelly with a visceral thickness. And there was a fractured, broken reflection in the eye that, at times, I swore I could see myself in. It was a masterpiece. Repulsive on nearly every level, but still executed with astonishing talent. When I asked Arlene if she had sent me anything, she said no, and I started to worry. Listing Arlene's address seemed very deliberate, and I wondered if perhaps it was meant as some kind of statement on behalf of the troll that told me, "I know where she lives." The idea terrified me. This was exactly the kind of escalation Arlene had been afraid of, and I was not only worried that she'd be upset with me, but I was deeply concerned that I had somehow risked her safety. With nothing to do, I had to sit and wait, even as more videos appeared over the next few days, the first of which showed someone walking down a suburban street, blown through with debris and rubbish. The sidewalk cracked and overgrown, and the road partially buried under gathering leaves and windswept soil. Every house was close to total collapse. Many of them showed signs of having been set ablaze a long time ago. It looked like it was the same location as the one from the very first video I received. After that, most of the videos focused on this guy going through different houses, often going through whatever personal items remained. Holding them up to the camera with shaky hands, I saw moldy, rain-soaked plush toys in the charred remains of a child's bedroom, long since faded underwear in a couple's chest of drawers, a cracked frame with fire-damaged photographs showing ghostly figures holding up a fish and smiling on the pier. Throughout every video, it was clear he was looking for something. Making his way through the whole ground floor, pulling back rugs and tearing up rancid carpet until he found a trapdoor, much like the one from earlier. Then, lifting it up, the camera would see either rope or a ladder descending into the darkness. The breathing would intensify, and then the video would end. Slowly, these clips started to unsettle me. I could not confide in Arlene, so I was forced to tell no one, while my mind worked overtime, trying to make sense of the videos and their meaning. It was as if a whole street had suffered a terrible fire, but I still could not figure out why the houses had been abandoned and left to rot. Nor did I have any idea as to why the cameraman was looking for those trap doors. The final correspondence I received from the troll was sent directly to me as a package and not a message, once again listing Arlene's home as the sender's address. This time, there was no giant canvas, just a small SD card filled with thousands and thousands of photos and clips. Amongst them, I recognized the several that had been sent to me, but there were others I had not seen, including one whose thumbnail had caught my eye the second it came into view. It was a photo of a half-burned room, the walls blackened and moldy as rain poured through the open rafters. There was even a hole in the floor that slipped into darkness, but it was the subject of the photo that I couldn't quite believe. It was Arlene's sculpture, the one she'd sent to me. There was even a little nick visible in the photo that I found on the real-life thing sitting on my dining table. Even as I held it to my nose, I detected the faint, unmistakable odor of fire and charcoal. Scrolling through even more photos and videos, I found a clip in the exact same house, showing the person shuffling through the house and nosing through various effects until they found the statue. Carefully stepping across the open beams, they reached out and took it from its place on the dresser, before returning downstairs and placing the statue to one side. Then, carefully, they searched for the trapdoor until they found it beneath the sofa. Slowly, they pulled the door aside and took the statue and carefully held it aloft over the great void below. They dropped it unceremoniously into the darkness before lowering the camera until the wooden portal disappeared and only blackness remained. The last few seconds showed nothing but fuzzy, pixelated blackness. And yet, I could not help but get the sense I was looking at something else, something both hidden and somehow familiar. There was a sense of something, some shape below. My heart raced and my chest tightened as the final seconds of that video ticked down, until I became convinced that I would see the same wretched eye from that painting open wide and glare at me through the screen. Except, it never did. The video ended. I let out a quivering breath, and then a fraction of a second later, my phone buzzed. It was Arlene. "I'm sorry," it read, and that was the last bit of correspondence I would receive from her for a long time. Nothing I wrote to her prompted a response. None of my messages were even read, and my calls went unanswered, but I kept trying anyway. For weeks, I fretted over the idea that the troll had found her, that this was all some sick joke to confuse and torture me before I finally snapped and hurt her, or worse. All the while, I couldn't stop poring over those clips and photos, obsessing over them, and desperately trying to find some clue that would help make it all make sense. But it never came. And, after a month had passed, it dawned on me that I would never hear from Arlene again without taking action. I would go to the address I had, I decided. And if all was well, and she was upset by my intrusion, then so be it. At least I'd know she was safe. And besides, my life had been consumed by these videos, Arlene and the people of Patterside. I had no hope of being able to carry on until I had some kind of meaningful answer. The address I had was for a house in Hope Hodgson, West Virginia, where Arlene had lived just a few miles outside of Patterside. A few days after, I finally decided to go. I was on a flight out there, ready to finally meet Arlene, for better or worse. I easily rented a car, got the necessary provisions, and started the long, painful drive through rural West Virginia until I eventually stopped at a small motel for the night, barely more than 3 or 4 hours away from Patterside. Whilst there, I took the opportunity to ask the receptionist about the town, making sure the directions I had were accurate. And yet, when I asked, she looked at me like I was an idiot. I knew I was a stranger, and a foreigner too, but I thought it unusual and asked again, only to receive a half-hearted apology and a shrug. "Ain't nothing around here like that. Sorry," she said. "What about Hope Hodgson then?" I asked. "Oh, you shouldn't go there," she replied. "So, there is a Hope Hodgson?" I asked. "It's just my friend said you live there, just outside the town of Patterside." "I know of a Hope Hodgson, but it ain't near nowhere else. And besides, I doubt she lived there at all, given what happened." "And what was that?" I asked. "A whole load of people would like to be able to answer that," she replied, a look of pity on her face. "Least of all the police. But I'm afraid there ain't no one left around here who could tell you. Not unless you manage to track down one of the few people who made it out of there alive." Quietly, I thanked her and went back to my room, where I slept fitfully all night, struggling to put aside memories and nightmares of that great wretched eye glaring at me from the darkness. Looking back, I can say comfortably that, deep down in my soul, I knew I would not find a healthy, normal house when I finally reached that address. The first sign of Hope Hodgson I found was a road cut off by a hefty gate reading "Private Property" that was easily swung open with a harmless push. Close by, I found the remains of a rusted chain that had been forcibly cut open. I drove down that road for another few miles until I finally came out onto a street that was instantly familiar. It was the one from the videos. Arlene's address, I knew, was at the end of that street, and so I kept going, despite the eerie and unpleasant effect of driving past a dozen houses with broken windows and rotting walls. It was an abandoned ghost town, seemingly partway through development or expansion. I couldn't say which, but some of the houses had scaffolding, others were not yet finished, and a fair few for sale signs that lay half buried beneath rising muck told me that this was likely a town undergoing some kind of development. It was clear something awful had happened, and not just because of what I'd been told. The wind blew ancient litter around in circles, possibly having done so for decades undisturbed, and fire-blackened windows, often broken and cracked, loomed at me from above as my car rolled slowly over the cracked and chipped tarmac that ground audibly beneath the wheels. In the distance, metal swung and scaffolding creaked, water dripped out of sight, and things scurried through the debris. In every shattered glass pane, smoky and grim, I was reminded that these places were once homes to people who had left it all behind, and no matter how much I told myself it didn't matter, I couldn't stop asking why. Arlene's house was, much as I had expected, the broken-down shell I'd seen in that video. What I hadn't expected to find was a two-seater car with slashed tires in the driveway. The windows had grown thick with dust, and I could see nothing trying to peer through them except a rolled-up bundle of sleeping bags. I did, however, get a clear sense that there had been more than one person in there, given the two thermos cups in the cup holders. But even the age of the car seemed off. It was newer than anything else around it, but it was still an 09 model that had been rusting there for a good 10 years. Stranger still, I found the keys nearby, dropped amid some leaves in a small drain, the ring snagged on a stick that had been caught in the grate. Using it, I opened the car door and had to stand back from the stench that wafted out. There was a fusty, moldy smell, typical of rotting fabric, but something else as well. Peering inside, I saw what it was. There was indeed a sleeping bag in the back, but it was not empty. It had an occupant. she had died long ago, with enough time to liquefy into the fabric that surrounded her, and then slowly dried out, leaching into the air and water around her, until nothing but bones and clothing remained, soaked in a putrid crust. As it started to rain, I sat in the driver's seat and pulled the door shut and began looking over her remains, trying my best to ignore how the growing patter of rain hid my surroundings and buried the silence. Carefully, I peeled the sleeping bag away from her hands. She'd been holding it up as if to cover her face, and found an older phone clutched in her hands. I tried to take it gently, but she must have laid there undisturbed for years, and my interference ended up snapping her thumb away at the joint. Disgusted, I gently pinched it back off the trunk bed and placed it on top of the body. The phone was clearly dead, and a quick check confirmed it. But I did notice it had a slot for an SD card that was missing, and I wondered if it was the same card I'd been sent. Looking through the dash, I did find some documents from a film company with paperwork typical of location scouts. Looking around, I realized that was likely who the car had belonged to, as well as the corpse. An abandoned ghost town would be a great place for a location scout to visit, I figured. But that didn't explain why they'd stayed here, nor why their tires were slashed. But I did find it interesting to note a small, sticky note with the word "Patricide" written on it and underlined, stuck to the back of a clipboard like some kind of reminder. When I left, I took a moment to check my own car and, finding it safe and sound, I went inside Arlene's house. It had indeed belonged to Arlene, or at least someone who had looked like her, though all the names on any mail I found belonged to other people. Otherwise, the house was as much as I'd seen on the clip sent to me, albeit clearly worse off in some areas. Going upstairs, I found the dresser where the statue had been, and traced the faded outline on the wood that had been left by its presence. Somehow, whatever had been there crossed oceans and was now sitting in my apartment, and I did not have the slightest clue as to how or why. Downstairs, I found a small pantry that had been cleared with two sleeping bags laid out on the floor. Following a trail of rusty stains away from the pantry, I found a jumble of bones close to the kitchen door, and a third sleeping bag, torn open. Looking at it, I guessed that a wild animal had found a dead body and dragged it outside. Nearby was a camera smashed to pieces and a few bits of paperwork confirming my earlier suspicions that they were location scouts, although I couldn't quite understand why they decided to stay the night. Although, some part of that question was answered when I found the trap door nearby, still open and with a sort of winch and pulley hanging over it. It couldn't possibly have held a person's weight, so I suspected it was actually to lower a camera into the void. Whatever it had held, the rope was now snapped and its quarry lost. Nor was it the only thing that had been lost down there. There was a streak of handprints, each one bearing four long fingers drawn in blood to eerie effect, snapped fingernails still visibly embedded in the linoleum. Carefully, I pulled the winch and pulley aside and leaned over the darkness. There was a long moment as I waited and watched, glaring down into the empty black, faintly aware that it wasn't just empty space. I could hear shuffling down there, and I called out, even telling them my name, though I could barely imagine why. After a quick rummage through a nearby rucksack, I found a glow stick that I cracked and dropped down the hole, hoping to gain some measure of its depth. Slowly, it tumbled away, on and on, until it was little more than a pinprick of starlight. And yet, it kept going. I was unprepared for the scale. It gave me a kind of vertigo as my mind came to terms with the sheer size of the cavern that I was looking at. Even minutes later, the light was still visible, and I wondered if it had perhaps come to a rest. I leaned down further to try to get a clearer look, but I couldn't be sure. it appeared for a moment, almost as if it was in a kind of black reflecting pool. And then it disappeared, and it reappeared with a sound like squelching mud. I leaned down even further until my whole head was inside the void. All around me, I could hear the dripping of condensation and a foul odor that I could barely withstand. But I stayed there, waiting for my eyes to adjust to the darkness. Slowly, the details of that pool below became clearer. There was the green pinprick of the flare, but something else. Another kind of luminosity flashed behind it, quite clearly in the shape of a square. And there, I realized, was a figure glaring back at me. "Hello?" I cried out, but there was no response. I stayed, willing myself to withstand the fetid stench and terrifying abyss until my eyes had adjusted completely to the dark. "Hello?" I cried out once more, balancing carefully so that I might fit one arm and wave at it. Somehow, the other figure waved back at me instantly, and for a split second, I was puzzled. And then it all somehow came into focus. It lurched forward, and I saw it was no reflecting pool. It was a pupil. Enormous. The glow stick was like a mote of dust upon its surface, and its sclera so vast that in darkness it appeared to be the very essence of shadow. I fled, stumbling backwards, straight out of that house, dropping my phone as I fumbled into my pocket to grab my car keys. I left it there, in a hysterical panic, as I ran as fast as I could back out the house and towards my car. I found myself inescapably afraid of the ground as my mind wrestled with the notion that that thing was somehow beneath me. The whole town must have rested atop an enormous chasm, some god-awful prehistoric hole with an even worse inhabitant, and I was standing right on top of it. It is a feeling I can best describe as that which an ant might feel when it witnesses a tarantula bearing down upon it out of some darkened hole. I was repulsed and horrified, and by the time I'd driven out of the town and back to the motel, I was a gibbering mess. I left, gladly, the next day. For a long time, I merely sat and stared at the distant hills and foggy rain. The world had seemed so big not that long ago, but looking at it then, and now, it was like staring at a child's toy. I've since checked, and I found two other people listed on the Facebook page whose name matched those of the dead location scouts. In fact, I've yet to find a person on there whose name isn't on a missing persons list. Almost all of them lost hiking in the Appalachia or having some obscure tie to urban exploration. I also returned to discover a single message from Arlene in my inbox, the sight of which made my skin crawl. Until they brought the wires, I had no one to speak to. "I hope you understand," she wrote. But that was not the worst part. No, that was the activity from my phone and my account. "Loved my trip to Patterside," was one of the many notifications I had posted in the prior week. "Spoke to Arlene and will be staying here for some time. Who knows, might even choose to live here forever. True love is hard to find," was another. Even now, my phone is still posting updates as if I'm still there somehow. All of these posts and replies I found are somehow being posted from my phone.
Wir sind Theresa und
Nemo
und deshalb sind wir zu Shopify gewechselt.
Die Plattform, die wir vor Shopify verwendet haben, hat regelmäßig Updates gebraucht, die teilweise dazu geführt haben, dass der Shop nicht funktioniert hat.
Endlich macht unser Nemo-Boards-Shop dadurch auch auf den Mobilgeräten eine gute Figur. Und die Illustrationen auf den Boards kommen jetzt viel, viel klarer rüber, was uns ja auch wichtig ist und was unsere Marke auch ausmacht.
Starte deinen Test noch heute für 1 Euro pro Monat auf shopify.de/radio.